Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Schools are wrapping up and summer feels like it's right around the corner, which means only one thing. Cedar Point and Kings Island will be opening up for the season, with Cedar Point unveiling its new coaster, Siren's Curse, opening later this summer. What makes Siren's Curse so special, and how does it compare to other coasters? Joining us now is Chandrasekhar Thamarai, Principal Lecturer for the Mechanical Engineering Department at the University of Maryland. Welcome to All Sides. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
So to start off, your work with and studying of roller coaster mechanics, do you go to amusement parks often and ride roller coasters?
Not lately. Mm-hmm. When I was much younger, until 40, and then I started feeling a little bit of nausea, so I stopped going. I do go to the theme parks, but not riding.
So you can go and look at the roller coasters now. See, we all reach that age one day when the roller coaster doesn't feel as good as it used to, right?
Right.
Do you have a favorite roller coaster that you used to ride in the Maryland area where you are?
Not the Maryland area, but King Da Ka, you know, so that's basically very amusing.
Okay, so whenever you look at roller coasters and the ones all around the country, where do Cedar Point and Kings Island stack up when it comes to the parks, you know, around the United States? Are they at the top of the list for coasters?
United States are, as I mentioned, King Da Ka especially, you could think that to be probably the second most exciting ones in the world. Again, that's very subjective, but people do often think that it's scary. It's because of the anticipation that one has, you know, during the ride.
Are you still there?
I'm not. Sorry, are you able to hear me?
Yeah, there we go. Okay, it just cut out for a second. That's okay, go ahead.
With the current tilt coaster that we have in Ohio, there is going to be a lot of anticipation once again about the tilt and then rejoining the tracks. So that, I'm assuming, would probably go in the top five or something in the future, I would feel, in terms of anticipation and fear.
Okay, yeah. So Cedar Point has this new coaster. That's what prompted us to want to do this segment on Tech Tuesday. Their new coaster is called Siren's Curse, and it's advertised as a tilt coaster. And if you watch a video of it, if you're sitting in the front row, I would think it's the most scary. But basically, it looks like you run out of track, and then the whole thing tilts 90 degrees, and then you go down. Is a tilt coaster kind of like, I don't know what I want to call it, a new innovation for the thrill of it?
Not necessarily new. Mm-hmm. There have been many trials of this over the years. And currently we do have a slightly bigger and faster one in Saudi Arabia too. And manufacturers have attempted doing this since the last at least 10 years. So they have been around. However, it's pretty challenging.
Okay. Yeah, you keep cutting out, so we might try to call you on your cell phone if we have that number. Otherwise, we're going to try.
Yes,
yeah,
no, or that,
you could
that's
just,
fine.
Yeah, maybe you could keep your video off. That might help as well for this. If you keep
Sounds
your video
good.
Off,
yeah.
It might help with the bandwidth. Yeah. Okay, so whenever we're talking about tilt coasters, so you were saying that it's not necessarily a new innovation, but is it, from an engineering standpoint, is it difficult? I mean, is it hard to make sure that everything stays on the track and stays safe whenever you're trying to make it more thrilling?
Yes. The challenges are basically to make sure that the tracks align properly. And then we must have a sensing mechanism which would sense that they're aligned, and then only the brakes need to be released. Then the when the riders are in the vertical position, the restraints must be able to hold the dead weight. So there is nothing else holding the top body of the riders. So that could be another challenge. But other than that, as long as the sensors tell us that the tracks are properly aligned, I think it would be fine to release the coaster and let it go.
Okay. So when you teach roller coasters related to mechanical engineering, what do you talk about whenever you talk about the mechanics of it and the safety? Is it do you mainly talk about just the safety part, or is it the effect on the riders, the thrill? Is that what's more important?
That's a very good point, Sai. So both, actually. We look at the mechanical challenges involving safety. So in terms of the train not leaving the tracks, for example, and the constraints or the restraints being strong enough so that the riders are in place. And then at the same time, we look at the biomechanics side of it to control the acceleration doses, meaning how much of acceleration we can have for how long. So acceleration, basically thrill comes from two parts. One is called kinematic thrill, and the second one is non-kinematic thrill. The non-kinematic thrills are the kind of things that we were talking about, anticipation and fear, or sudden introduction of something like King Kong at somebody, you know, suddenly coming in front of the coaster, or tunnels, you know, sudden water spray and all that. But kinematic thrills are expected to be simply speed, height, and the third is acceleration. So we're at the top of a hill, you know, when the train is basically relatively steady, and then it goes down, and at the bottom, if we have a loop. So when the coaster turns in the loop, there's going to be heavy acceleration, and there'll be a lot of weight felt, maybe sometimes 6 to 7 times the weight of the person. And then similarly, at the top of a loop, when the riders are upside down, there could be no weight sense. So there also restraints are important. But in both these cases, we have to also worry about the body, whether the organs are going to be able to take that much of internal pressure. And then similarly, at the top, it's not too much of a problem. It's just weightlessness. So that's not too bad. So those are some of the things that we look at. So based on that, we kind of try to assign students projects so that they can design layouts. While designing the layout, there would be certain specifications. So what's the maximum speed going to be? That should come from riders and theme park interests. What should the height be? How much of a thrill? How long should the ride be? How many passengers? Or riders per train, how many trains, et cetera. So based on all that, a track would be designed, and then velocities and that is the speeds and accelerations are determined through modeling, simple dynamics. And then using those, the trains and tracks and whatever structure, the frames, all those are mechanically designed. So we use simple hand calculations first, and then we back check with simulations. So once all that is done, well, this will keep on going, but go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that of everything that you said, it was what I found most striking was you have to like pay attention to the speed and the velocity and the flipping to make sure everyone's organs stay in place. That was an interesting part to me. Right. Yeah. So yeah, just continue. So basically you have students who are designing roller coasters, and they have to take all of this into consideration.
Yes. Yeah. As part of this course, which I believe is the only one in the USA at the undergrad level, as part of this, they have to come up with making a model roller coaster. They display it, and then they design the full roller coaster just on the paper and through simulations and finite element simulations is what we call it, to make sure safety-wise they are okay, et cetera. For the model roller coasters, they make sure to take care of safety in terms like we make another train stop on the tracks and the oncoming train should be automatically sensing that and stop. Right. So things like that, we make sure that they adhere to. And then we always check some of the restraint designs and train designs, wheels, brakes on the tracks, and so on. So we make sure that they're all well designed.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about roller coasters with Chandra Sekhar Thamare, principal lecturer for mechanical engineering in the department at the Mechanical Engineering Department at the University of Maryland. What would you say are some of the biggest innovations of roller coasters that you've seen in the last couple of years? What big changes have really made coasters bigger and better and faster?
Previously, roller coasters used to be based only on gravity. So we used to have chains which would engage to the train and take it up lift hill slowly, which actually builds up to the thrill. So it is not a bad thing at all. But more recently, we have had other ways of launch systems using linear synchronous motors, induction motors, and hydraulic and pneumatic launches, et cetera, which basically can propel the coaster very quickly, meaning that just like a sports car, so one can go up to speeds above 120, 140 mph within 5-6 seconds. So that itself is another thrill too. So the ability to do that and to make sure that everything else is designed to withstand that, you know, that's been an innovation in engineering.
Now, I grew up going to a tiny amusement park in western Pennsylvania called Kennywood, and they are known for having one of the oldest working wooden roller coasters in the nation. And I would have to think that, so wooden roller coasters are the ones that are on this, like, that chain mechanism that you were saying. And like that was the old technology and they all used to be like that. But now, the wooden roller coaster, I guess, is just an ancient thing. Would you agree?
Not exactly. I mean, that is still very thrilling, you know, all the creaking and all those noises. Of course, you can't have a full inverting loops and things like that in wooden roller coasters.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I think they have their own, flavor.
Yeah.
So they're still very attractive, I believe, to many people.
Now, I believe we were talking about Siren's Curse earlier at Cedar Point, which will open later this summer. Cedar Point's open now, but I guess Siren's Curse is not quite ready yet. And I think it goes up to 60 miles per hour. So how does that compare to other coasters? What is fast?
I believe that the one in Saudi Arabia, I think it's called Iron Rattler, I believe that has a top speed of 73 mph. This is just from the specifications that we have that we show to my students usually, but which is not bad at all. And then compared to the current height, I believe 160 feet maybe for the Siren's Curse. Iron Rattler is at 208 feet, so slightly bigger. But this compares very well with the peak top one.
And How does height play in versus speed? Do you need the height to get the speed, or has there been technology that can help you get fast without going too high?
Right. Generally, square root of gh, acceleration due to gravity times height, that plays a big role in terms of the velocity. So the higher we go, if you take approximately square root multiplied by some factors, that will enhance the velocity.
Now,
so velocity will be more, basically, if you have a tall coaster.
Yeah, and whenever your students are designing these coasters, you know, they're just probably, you know, they're using their imagination and trying to make it as good as possible. Do you talk to them about safety? Do you have, like, these models you build and you're like, well, all those people just fell off your coaster. Why did that happen?
Yes. So basically, we do show them past accidents, which have been rare, but still just like restraints coming loose, right? And then people falling down or one coaster hitting a coaster that is stopped and so on to show, I mean, to take this seriously. And we always tell them to take a backup. In case one mechanism fails, there must be a backup in emergency situations. So we go ahead and teach them in terms of mechanics and all electronic systems required to achieve that.
And a lot is always said about the height of a person when they're riding the roller coaster. Is that something that your course or someone in your field would take into account of how tall or short for that matter, like what height they need to be on the roller coaster?
It basically depends on the coaster. So any coaster can be designed to accommodate specific height ranges. So for a particular coaster that is designed to accommodate, again, we have to design the restraints and seating based on the person's height, basically, right? And then, so if the restraint doesn't match our need, so if the restraint has been designed for an average height of 5 feet 9 inches, let's say, right? And if there is a 5 feet person sits in there, it may become too risky. They may come out loose. And then we have to look at situations like that. So the range of those heights will depend on the specific restraint design and the coaster. And the restraints are designed to match the coaster speeds and accelerations and all these. Right. So if you have twisting loops versus, no twist loops, restraints can be different.
Yeah, and Cedar Point just came out before they opened for this season that they lowered the height requirement on on two coasters, and they raised the height requirement on one coaster. Does that mean that they just reconsidered things, or do you think they changed the mechanics of the actual like structure that's holding you in the coaster?
It could be. So the maintenance is done typically every 6 months during off seasons. So at that point, they could have reevaluated or redesigned the restraints to match standards. ASTM F24 is a set of standards that we normally use to design. And there are state regulations also, which change from state to state. So based on that, if restraints have changed, then the height regulations also will have to change with that to match the restraints.
Yeah, and LeBron James is famously too tall for five of the 17 coasters at Cedar Point. So there is that factor where you can be too tall as well.
Right, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today. Thanks for talking to me about roller coaster technology and roller coaster engineering. I appreciate it. Thank you to Chandra Sekar Thamare, principal lecturer for the Mechanical Engineering Department at the University of Maryland. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a wonderful day.
And coming up, we are going to talk about tech policy news. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jarovich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Artificial intelligence can't keep itself out of the courthouse. A new bill that sped through Congress sets to outlaw and further criminalize deepfake and AI-generated explicit images of people. Joining us now is Will Oremus, a technology news analysis writer for The Washington Post. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday, Will.
Sammy, you got that whole title right. I'm impressed.
Did I? It's a lot of words. Okay. So I wanted to ask you about the Take It Down Act. Can you start off by walking us through what the Take It Down Act does?
Yes. So first of all, I think it's worth noting that this is a real and growing problem that it's seeking to address. The technical term for it is non-consensual intimate imagery, or NCII. That includes a few categories of things. One is sometimes colloquially known as revenge porn. It's when somebody, maybe an ex of yours, has intimate imagery or videos of you, and they post it online without your consent. This is not a new problem. It's one that's been around for a long time, but it is one that has been criminalized by many states, but never at the federal level before. Within that category of revenge porn is also a growing problem known as sextortion. This one often affects teenage boys. A scammer online will pose as a girl and ask them to send naked images of themselves. And then when they send it, they will extort the person. They'll blackmail them for money or other things. It's led to some tragic results. And then the final category is the one you alluded to, which is deepfake nudes or deepfake sexually explicit imagery, where somebody takes your face and uses AI to simulate nude images of you or sexually explicit videos of you, and then they distribute that. And so those things will all be criminalized under federal law once this bill is signed into law. And then there's a second part of the Take It Down Act, which requires online platforms, when they're notified that this sort of material has been posted, they have to take it down within 48 hours. So this is a new responsibility for social networks like Facebook or Snapchat, TikTok, Reddit. They have to take this stuff down quickly or they will face enforcement consequences from the Federal Trade Commission.
Now, so if it's federal now, you said some states had this. So basically, if you get caught and you're identified as the person who posted it, you're now guilty of a federal crime. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And so what that one thing that that does is, you know, before when we had a patchwork of state laws where some allowed it and some didn't, there were tons of these websites that operated and they could say, well, you know, we're just doing it in the states where it's legal. Mm-hmm. Now there are no states where it's legal anymore.
And did this bill have supporters on both sides of the aisle?
Did. You know, it is the incredibly rare bill that passed with genuine bipartisan support. The vote, I believe it was unanimous in the Senate, so 100-0, and then it was something like 409-2 in the House. And it's expected to be signed by President Trump because one of the people who backed this bill and gave it a big push along the way was First Lady Melania Trump. She took it up as part of her the revival of her Be Best campaign against cyberbullying.
So basically, this is a rare instance, especially nowadays, where everyone can agree on something.
Yeah, incredibly rare. And, you know, I should say not everyone agrees because there are some digital rights groups. These are sort of think tanks that think about internet policy and the best way to make it, who worry that the way that this bill is crafted could have impacts on free expression online. And to be clear, these groups don't support anyone posting revenge porn or deepfake nudes online. What they say, though, is that the way the bill, the takedown notice, the part where the platforms have to take stuff down within 48 hours, there's no penalty. There is a penalty if they don't take down stuff, but there's no penalty if they do take down stuff that wasn't actually revenge porn, it wasn't actually a deepfake nude. So the concern here is that, let's say you're a bad actor and you don't want a certain type of content online, you're going to report that to a platform and they won't even check. They'll just go ahead and take it down. So the concern is, for instance, if a group doesn't like any content about transgender identities online, they could go and report that to all the platforms as being revenge porn, and the platforms will just take it down without looking. That's the speculative concern. We don't actually know how it will play out yet.
I was wondering if groups like, you know, Facebook and Reddit and all the other ones you mentioned, all the social media sites, did they have any concerns about this being a federal law, or did they support it being enacted?
Yeah, so Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, as well as Snapchat and other big tech companies, did come out in support of this bill. It's you know, again, it's the rare tech regulation that got support from some of the tech lobby. I think because from their perspective, the burden on them is pretty light, and they don't really want to be hosting this stuff either. It's not that they want to have this stuff on their networks. This just gives them a little extra nudge to be really responsive when somebody reports it. Because part of the problem, I should say, is that, you know, there was testimony in the hearings from a girl in Texas where a classmate had posted deepfake nudes of her and circulated them on Snapchat to all her classmates. And she was trying to get it taken down. She and her family were trying to get it taken down. They couldn't get a response from these social networks. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just, you know, if you've ever tried getting a response from Facebook when you're locked out of your account or have a problem or something like that, I mean, it's like almost impossible. There's no customer service. And so there was just this weeks-long, maybe months-long nightmare that people like her faced, trying to get even a human on the line at these platforms. It only finally happened when she contacted her senator, Ted Cruz, and he got in touch with Snapchat, and then they took it down. So this hopefully, you know, will change that process.
Yeah, and Tim Wu, who advised President Biden on tech regulation, he said that more needs to be done to protect children and vulnerable people. What do you make of this statement? Does that mean that there's even more to this than the Take It Down Act? There's more they could be doing?
I mean, this is a pretty narrow bill. I mean, this, you know, you talked about how it's rare to have bipartisan support, partly because that's because this is extremely focused on a couple categories of content that pretty much everybody agrees are vile and are also not protected by the First Amendment, right? I mean, that's a key here. There's a lot of bad stuff online that is First Amendment protected speech. You know, misinformation is largely protected by the First Amendment. You can lie, and that doesn't get you put in jail, right? You can even lie online to a lot of people, but that's your right to do so. But you don't have the right to do things like you know, post intimate images of someone without their consent. That's not protected. But there has been a much broader push to protect kids online with all sorts of other laws that go much further. One of them that nearly reached the critical mass last year was called the Kids Online Safety Act, or COSA. This would have imposed a much greater burden on online platforms, called a duty of care, to look out for the interests of young people, and they could face consequences if they aren't acting in a protective way of young people's interests. There are also all kinds of bills making their way through states across the country and now introduced in Congress that would require age verification for young people online. And some of them would make apps like Facebook and Snapchat do that work. Others, there's sort of a new momentum behind ones that would require Apple and Google, the companies that make the software that powers your smartphone, to actually do age verification at the level of the whole device for young people. Those have yet to pass, but we could see more action on these fronts.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, lying is not illegal. But when we talk about AI-generated images, I mean, meanwhile, you see AI-generated images of President Trump even that are very flattering. They depict him with big muscles as a hero. There's one that depicts him as the Pope. And Trump himself, the White House social media accounts have sent those out. Can we police all fake images like that?
No, the answer is very clear. I mean, the First Amendment is a very broad and powerful protection for all kinds of speech, including unpopular speech, distasteful speech. Most legal experts I've talked to say that that's going to cover a lot of AI-generated and AI-manipulated images. There's no law against propaganda. There's, you know, an AI image showing Trump as the Pope or the King or whatever is not, I don't think, different in the eyes of the law than somebody drawing a picture of that, right, with a pen and paper. So the types of speech that the government can regulate are pretty limited by the First Amendment. What can happen is that online platforms, I mean, they have no obligation to publish something just because it's First Amendment protected. They can choose what they post, what they allow, and what they don't. And the Supreme Court basically upheld that in some big high profile recent cases for instance, the states of Texas and Florida passed laws saying that Facebook can't take down speech based on political viewpoint, right? They can't censor conservative views. The Supreme Court said, oh yes, they can. It's not censorship when a private company is doing it. It's only censorship when the government makes a law against it. So the platforms can absolutely make rules and say, we won't allow AI manipulated images, or they could say, you have to label them if you want to post them on here. But as AI images get harder and harder to detect, you know, enforcing those types of rules becomes challenging.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you if this Take It Down Act is a stepping stone toward more AI regulation, but I guess only certain types, not all of it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest issues for any attempt to regulate what people can post online or what people can distribute online is making sure you're not running afoul of the First Amendment by making a law that abridges free expression. So, but that's not to say that there can't be other regulations. There are regulations that focus on transparency, for instance. There have been pushes for Congress to adopt a law that says if you're making an AI model that's you know, a certain size or a certain potency, you might have to register with some independent agency that can review it and make sure that it can't be used for evil or fall into the wrong hands. So there are certainly other types of regulation that can pass, but they always have to be careful not to step into the territory of saying what people are allowed to say or what people are allowed to post online if it's First Amendment protected.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about some recent tech news with Will Oremus, a technology news analysis writer for The Washington Post. I wanted to pivot to another thing that you've been writing about related to technology policy. Ohio's own Congressman Jim Jordan put forth a proposal that would strip the Federal Trade Commission of its antitrust authority. Antitrust means protecting trade and commerce from monopolies and unfair business practices. What exactly does Jim Jordan's proposal, what does he want to do?
So this is an idea that has been kicking around in conservative circles for years. Right now, antitrust enforcement authority at the federal level is split between two agencies. One is the Department of Justice, and one is the Federal Trade Commission. In the past, the DOJ and the FTC have kind of divvied up what sorts of cases they'll take. Sometimes it's prescribed by law, like there are laws that say the DOJ has authority over this or the FTC has authority over that. Other times they kind of just put their heads together and figure it out. So about 5 years ago, both the DOJ and the FTC decided they wanted to take on big tech and see how these old, you know, 100-year-old antitrust laws that are designed to prevent monopolies might apply to tech giants who mostly offer their services for free online. So we're talking about, you know, does Google have a monopoly over online search? And if so, is that a problem? Does Meta have a monopoly over social networking? Does Amazon have a monopoly over e-commerce? Does Apple have a monopoly over its app store and over all the iPhone, you know, the stuff that people can put on their iPhones? And so the DOJ took the Google and Apple cases, the FTC took the Amazon and Meta cases, and both agencies are proceeding. The idea that's been kicking around is, look, maybe we should just have one agency do this. And so Representative Jordan's bill, we included a provision. This was actually a broader reconciliation bill, but tucked in there was a provision that would have stripped the FTC of its antitrust enforcement authority. This is a move that is favored by a lot of giant businesses because they would prefer to only have one agency to worry about when it comes to antitrust. But there was evidently some pressure from within his own party, because when the bill came for markup, Congressman Jordan himself, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, decided to remove that provision. I think, you know, what I heard from my sources was somebody else in the Republican Party who wants the FTC to be taking on these tech giants and other big businesses tapped him on the shoulder and said, look, no, you can't do this. This is, President Trump doesn't want this. The rest of the party doesn't want this. And he evidently acquiesced.
Okay. Yeah. That is a little confusing, though, to have two departments doing it and them just basically deciding who takes up which case. Whether it's the Justice Department, because for some reason, in my opinion, like being looked into by the Justice Department seems worse than the Federal Trade Commission. I don't know why.
Yeah. It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think there are the experts I've talked to on this say, yeah, you look, there are valid arguments to be made about why you might want to consolidate authority in just one agency. But all the ones I talked to said this is like the worst possible time to do it, because the FTC is in the middle of some absolutely gargantuan cases. It is at trial with Meta, attempting to break up Meta and make it split off Instagram and WhatsApp. It is headed to trial next year with Amazon. It has been taking a much more active role. So the FTC is in charge of consumer protection. And so that, and also like, on, you know, data privacy, that sort of thing. And so the FTC has been playing an increasingly pivotal role, especially in the last administration, where Lina Khan, a trust buster, a modern day trust buster, took over the FTC as chair. It has been playing a really aggressive role in trying to break up some of these giant businesses that have really become more powerful than arguably any businesses in world history, you know, maybe going back to the era of the first big trusts when Teddy Roosevelt took them on 100 years ago.
Okay, so as of right now, the proposal from Jim Jordan has been stopped, and we're going to just proceed as we are with what the FTC is doing and what the Justice Department is doing.
That's correct. I don't think the idea is dead, but it is noteworthy. I mean, the Democrats are unlikely to get behind this at this moment. And if the Republicans aren't unified in wanting to do this, then it's probably not going to happen right now. So it goes back to this big tension within Trump's Republican Party right now. There are sort of the traditional people who represent big business interests. And while Congressman Jordan talks a big game about wanting to take on big tech, he, in fact, tends to align with the big tech lobby on most issues. And then there's another wing of the party, the Stephen Millers, the Steve Bannons. There's the populist wing that really does want to fight big tech companies and impose tariffs and that sort of thing. And so the party is at war with itself at the moment, and that's why this isn't going to move forward.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. Will Oremus, a technology news analysis writer for The Washington Post. Will, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Amy.
Coming up, we're going to talk about how to delete yourself from the internet and if that is actually possible. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. This is Tech Tuesday. With the advent of the internet went the days that most of your private information remains private. Even if you try to minimize the personal information you place online, people can still find out a lot about you on the web, whether you like it or not. And while it may seem impossible, a recent Wall Street Journal article details how you can actually delete yourself from the internet. Joining us now is Wall Street Journal personal tech columnist Nicole Nguyen. Welcome to All Sides, Nicole.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So do you think most people are aware of how much personal information really is online?
No, the most savvy people might be, but I have been covering technology for over a decade, and I was shocked at the amount of personal data that I had exposed to anyone who would be willing to look or pay a buck for that information.
And it's not just if you have social media and you willingly put your entire life on Instagram or Facebook. It's even if you don't have Instagram or Facebook, some of your personal information is on the internet, right?
Absolutely. You know, personal information has been publicly disseminated for a long time. The Yellow Book, White Pages have long listed people's addresses and phone numbers, but because of all of the data that is collected about us when we sign up for a new credit card, for example, not only are you handing over your address and maybe some of your bank details, but maybe your income, which that credit card doesn't really need. I mean, yes, they can expand your credit line, but that data can be shared with data brokers and combined with other publicly available information about you.
Now, your article, the headline is "Go Delete Yourself from the Internet. Seriously, Here's How," which great headline. And then the subhead says "Find Your Data, Request Removal, and Repeat." So it's a catchy headline, but is it actually possibly true? You can delete yourself from the internet.
You can delete your information from many, many websites at once if you use certain tools, but to completely scrub your data from the internet is, we would need another hour to discuss how to do that.
Okay, well, tell us your experience about one tool that you use, the Google's Results About You tool.
So the reason why I wrote this column in the first place is because Google updated its tool called Results About You. And this is a free tool that anyone with a Google account can use. And it really was an eye-opening experience. So you log into Google, you go into settings, you click Results About You, and immediately it starts surfacing Google search results that include your home address, phone number, email, any data that you decide to give Google. And Google promises not to use this data for of any other purposes. Excuse me. And it surfaced some databases, some data brokers that had this information of mine, even though I requested removal from those databases years ago. And I realized from in doing this exercise that these websites that are called people search websites or data brokers can refresh their databases and gain and collect your information back in other ways. So when you opt out of some of these websites, you have to continue to remove your data because there are other data sources that they can purchase in the future.
I thought it was interesting that to use the Google Results About You tool, you have to give it a bunch of information for it then to go find that. And Google promises not to give that information to anyone else. And I find myself rolling my eyes and being like, sure, sure, sure.
Yeah, I, you know, it's something that I was skeptical about at first, but Google probably has a lot more information about you that's sensitive than your home address, phone number, and email, including every search that you've ever done, including, you know, that weird rash that you had last year. So I was
Google
like,
knows
okay.
everything about you. Yes, I know. All right.
Probably.
So it must be time consuming, though, because in addition to this tool, what other services are there? There's companies. I had no idea this was even a business where you can like get a company to help you remove information from the internet.
Yeah, so Google's free tool just scratches the surface. These are only search results that include this information. But if you are the target of a doxing campaign, and that's the malicious use of your personal info in order to swat you or share your personal info in other malicious ways, people can go straight to what's called these people search or search websites where they plug in your name, your email address, your location, and they can get an entire dossier about you. And to remove your information from these services, and there are hundreds of such services, you have to manually go to each service, request an opt-out removal, and that includes sometimes giving up more personal data to remove your listing, like uploading your driver's license, for example, and then waiting. And sometimes it can take weeks, it can take months, sometimes they don't. And so you have to request multiple times. And so there are paid services, including two that I reviewed called Optory and Delete Me, that request these opt-out, that request these removals for you.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides. I'm Amy Jarovich, and we're talking about how to delete our personal information from the internet. It is possible, within reason. With us is Wall Street Journal personal tech columnist Nicole Nguyen. So what advice do you have for people who want to delete themselves from the internet, or at least minimize their footprint a little bit, maybe get a few things cleaned up?
So these services are pricey. You know, it's not $0, but you can get an exposure report for free, which is this PDF that shows you what websites have some of your information, and you can get a sense of what's out there. And if you're willing to pay, Optory has a budget-friendly $4 a month plan, and Delete Me, which is this, 14 years in the business, season-long timer, offers only a yearly plan for $129. Signing up for these services once is a good idea. I think it lets people see what's out there, and you can do a first round of scrubbing. And maybe in a year or 2 years, you can sign back up again and remove that information again. But the advice that I have for most people is to prevent that data from getting out there in the first place. And listen, it's really difficult to prevent this information from getting out there. If you online shop, if you sign up for credit cards, if you have magazine subscriptions, if you've ever filled out a warranty card, that's one way these data brokers can get your address and other information about you. But there are, you know, other things that you can do, like turning on Do Not Track on your phone, which disables the ability for apps to track your activity across different websites. Avoid posting sensitive information like, you know, where your kids go to school publicly on social media, because social media is definitely a very rich source of information for a lot of these data brokers that can scrape it automatically and then add that information to your dossier. And lastly, mask your identity when you're signing up for new websites. Use a burner email address. Delete Me, that service that can request removals for you, offers burner email addresses. Use a burner phone number, like through Google Voice. And you might even want to use a fake birthday, but use that same fake birthday across multiple websites just in case you have to recover your account.
I understand what a burner phone is. What's a burner email address? Because you still would like log into it to click on things for, you know, authentication purposes, right?
So the way that Delete Me handles a burner email address is it looks like gibberish at saydeleteme.com, and it forwards emails to your main email address, and you can block the sender at any time. So the sender doesn't have your main email address that you use to take in, you know, personal correspondence and other important things like your airline reservation. And it makes sure that if that service that you're signing up for happens to sell their customer data, your main email address is not a part of that sale.
Interesting. Okay. So, but is there a chance of a Medusa effect here regarding the elimination of information? Because, for instance, I swear when I unsubscribe from a junk email, it ends up getting me more junk email. Like, I feel like those unsubscribe buttons are like phishing as well. So I feel like when I try to do something, it'll just make it worse.
Yes. For the services that already have your information, it's difficult to stop the flow, but it's kind of like, you know, the weeds growing on your lawn. You have to continually cut back, prune, and eventually with the right digital hygiene, you can sort of stop the flow. You can also declare email bankruptcy and just start a new email address.
I've done that before. It's just because the junk mail got to be too much. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good feeling to declare email bankruptcy, I will say. Blocking senders that are really persistent, reporting spam, which is a tool in both Outlook and Google that that one can use to train Outlook and Google that this is junk mail that you do not want to receive. Mm-hmm. Doing that really diligently can help.
Now, is there a way to delete information from the internet for a loved one who has passed away?
That is a great question. You can use these services like Optory and Delete Me to do that. You would probably need a form of identification from them, like a driver's license, in order to do so. It's really important to do so increasingly because scammers, identity thieves, can take information like one social security number from those who have passed away to file taxes on their behalf and receive their tax return, for example. So if you are in charge of someone's estate, that's a great thing to do.
So is it better or worse nowadays with all of this to have a common name? You know, all those John Smiths out there. Does that make it more confusing for people to steal information if you have a common name versus a more unique name?
It's better in some ways. Like, for example, if you are a public figure, an executive, or just the victim of a doxing campaign, if a stranger on the internet is trying to target you, it would be really hard for them to find you specifically. But for identity thieves who target people based on the information that they have, no, your John Smith name does not really protect you.
So in writing this article, and I'm sure you got a lot of reaction to it, just because, especially even from the catchy headline, what's the most interesting thing you learned about your personal information or someone else who contacted you about trying to delete personal information?
Well, yes, you can delete what I call medium hanging fruit from these data brokers and people search websites, you know, folks who are savvy and want your information can go to these websites and get it. But you cannot delete your information from what's called the dark web, which is the high hanging fruit. You know, you need a ladder to get your address, your spouse's name, maybe your vehicle purchase history, et cetera. But things like your social security number or your driver's license number or other sensitive data has probably been leaked as a part of a company data breach. You know, when you get those emails that are like, sorry, your email address and password have been a part of a data breach and you need to reset your password now. That information often ends up on what's called the dark web, which is this encrypted, secretive underbelly of the internet. It's like a second internet that a lot of criminals use in order to steal your identity, open a bank account in your name, open a credit card in your name, or try to hack into your accounts. And it is very difficult to scrub this information. And so one way you can protect yourself from that is by making sure your credit is frozen through three credit reporting agencies so people can't open those financial accounts in your name, and use a password manager to create a unique and long password to every single one of your accounts.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with Wall Street Journal personal tech columnist Nicole Nguyen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.